Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here with
Scott Tobias,
Genevieve Kosky,
and Tasha Robinson is once again out this week, but will return for our next episodes. Here on The Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So, every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we're paying tribute to the late Jonathan Demme via a pair of joyous concert films. Genevieve, can you tell us a bit more about our selections?
Certainly. When Demme died on April 26th at the age of 73, we lost a director of incredible range and empathy, capable of working across a broad range of genres. He earned his greatest fame and acclaim for the 1991 thriller The Silence of the Lambs, but he preceded that film with comedies like Something Wild and Mary to the Mob, and followed it with Philadelphia, a drama about AIDS that doubled as a plea for tolerance and understanding. Demme also made a number of documentaries and, most relevant to us for this episode, concert films.
Demme never made the same film twice, but his films have a shared, generous spirit that's an ample supply in a pair of concert movies he made decades apart. 1984's Stop Making Sense, starring Talking Heads, and his final film, 2016's Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids, which captures the final concerts in Timberlake's 2020 Experience Tour. We'll be holding our lighters aloft for both after the break.
Tape I want to play.
To understand what Stop Making Sense is, it helps understand what it's not. And finding a point of comparison is pretty easy. Just a year before Stop Making Sense, the Rolling Stones released a movie called Let's Spend the Night Together. And though directed by the great Hal Ashby, it's as dull a concert film as you'll ever see. The Stones look bored while performing their greatest hits under a sign welcoming, quote, Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones, which probably helped contribute to the band's mood. Part of the band that's not Mick Jagger, that is. The camera stays low and treats the band members as preening gods, cutting frequently to a crowd that's working itself into a frenzy that the film does nothing to make infectious. At one point, Jagger wears a football jersey, for reasons known only to him. Let's Spend the Night Together isn't an unusually bad concert movie. It is, for the time, a typically bad concert movie. With rare exceptions, The Last Waltz comes immediately to mind, concert films had a hard time translating the spirit of a live performance to film. Stop Making Sense changed all that, in part by telling a story. The film opens with a bare stage, soon filled by Talking Heads frontman David Byrne, who brings with him a beatbox and a beat, and launches into a solo performance of the 1977 song Psycho Killer. Then, slowly, he's joined by band members Tina Weymouth, then Chris France, then Jerry Harrison, and the sound gets fuller and more complex with each song. Then others fill out the lineup, including Parliament keyboardist Bernie Worrell, guitarist Alex Weir, percussionist Steve Scales, and backup singers Adina Holt and Lynn Mabry. With each addition, the energy builds and grows, and through it all, Demi shoots the band not as gods, but as characters in a drama that changes with each song, from the existential epiphanies of Once in a Lifetime to the sweetness of This Must Be the Place to the unbridled joy of the film closing Cross-Eyed and Painless. Yet for all the obvious choreography and preparation needed to make the film happen, Demi keeps it loose, letting his camera linger on the players not just during the instrumental heroics, but as they interact with one another. He lets the sweat show. As staged by Demi, the band, designer Adele Lutz, and cinematographer Jordan Cronenworth, Stop Making Sense doesn't attempt to reinforce the mythology of the Talking Heads' greatness. It just shows it. When Demi finally, in the final moments of the final song, cuts to some audience reaction shots after keeping the crowd in the soft, focused distance, it feels earned. And it feels like a confirmation. Yes, the show was that good. And though we weren't there in Los Angeles in 1983 when it was recorded, for 90 minutes, Stop Making Sense makes us feel like we didn't miss a thing. So guys, whenever there's a discussion on the greatest concert film ever made, Stop Making Sense is always in the mix and usually at the top of the list. Having just rewatched this film, is that earned?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's move episode on. Episode over.
The episode is over, yeah. It's absolutely. I think it has no peer. It's certainly at the time, there have been plenty of great concert films. I mean, you could look at Gimme Shelter or The Last Waltz. I mean, there's an interesting comparison between Stop Making Sense and The Last Waltz, because both films were by major filmmakers. I mean, Last Waltz was Scorsese, and both films are very meticulously planned out and choreographed and really made for the screen. But Demi cuts away some of the indulgences in The Last Waltz that we're familiar with from a lot of concert films and really just gives you the pure stuff. And I think conceptually, on David Byrne's part, on the Talking Heads' part, the film is just miles above anything.
Yeah, I mean, it is a mix, too. It's kind of what I got into in the keynote a little bit, but you get these amazingly composed shots where everything is, the lighting is perfect. Everyone, there's that one shot of like the two different rows of musicians, and they almost seem to be in different like planes of existence or something. Mm-hmm. It's so wonderful. But also you get these really loose moments, like, you know, Byrne dancing with the backup singers. Yeah, there's a lot of spontaneity, and I think, you know, you get just a few moments of people just kind of doing their thing, you know, that don't feel choreographed. And it's a nice mix there too. It's not completely like, I love The Last Waltz, but it is, I think it was storyboarded. I mean, I'm sure this was too, but The Last Waltz feels storyboarded in the way this doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, there's a narrative happening in The Last Waltz, and you know, there, it's like interspersed with these other segments besides the concert, and Stop Making Sense is just so much more pure. It is about this one performance and this one experience. And there is kind of a story or a narrative happening, but it's all in that performance. There's not a larger story being told, or like the band isn't being deified the way they are kind of in The Last Waltz. It's a very pure concert film experience.
You don't have Robbie Robertson's ego swelling.
I don't want to bag on The Last Waltz. I think The Last Waltz is
an important
film, but I mean, it's also just a perfect collaboration, an equal collaboration really between Demi and Byrne, because, you know, with Byrne, so much is owed to his conceit. You know, I mean, there's a continuity and an arc to the performance that's sort of baked into it, where you start with the bare stage and you keep adding performers and visual elements, and you know, the frame expands and you've got all of these performers on stage, and it feels like this wonderful build-up. And that's something that you can credit Byrne with. And then on Demi's part, I think he really tried hard to make Stop Making Sense a specific cinematic achievement, not rather than, you know, sort of the live supplement that we're used to, that we're sure. often mm-hmm. used to seeing, you know, as part of a band's work. I mean, he got, you know, the titles are by Pablo Ferro, who did, you know, Dr. Strangelove. He's got Jordan Cronenweth, his cinematographer, who did Blade Runner 2 years before. You know, he's using, you know, digital audio techniques that had never been used before. Mm-hmm. So he cared very much about the sound of the film, you know, and had a substantial budget. I mean, this was like, this is a real film. It's not a film performance.
In some ways, the story it's telling is also the story of the band, where it starts with this very spare sound. You have Psycho Killer, which first, like, not hit, but maybe the first signature song. And it's kind of a piece with those first couple albums, which is, you know, David Byrne as a sort of this almost alien figure from a distance trying to figure out how the world works. And then as you add members and influences, like, you know, you find like sort of the African rhythms they would bring in, some of their later ones. Many of the musicians were the same they used for their 1979-1980 tour, which was widely acclaimed and really opened up the sound of the band. So you kind of see that playing out over the course of this film in a really interesting way. And it ends like, you know, this Cross-Eyed and Painless is such an ecstatic performance. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's really nowhere to go from there. It is a natural climax to the film. It's remarkably well put together. I love how each one is its own film. It works beautifully together, but each one's kind of a film unto itself, mm-hmm. too.
Like each song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's What a Day That Was.
Yeah,
like that could stand alone as a music video, mm-hmm. the way it is shot, like with those ghostly lit from below shots of the individuals and then kind of panned out to the shadow play on the whole stage. It's just distinctive within the film as its own standalone piece.
And that specific one too is one where, you know, the camera is held for a really long time. Most of that song you're fairly close on David Byrne's face, you know, with the occasional cutaway, so where you can see those silhouettes. So he does like to mix things up style wise and as Keith was saying before, there is a playfulness and a spontaneity to it. One of my favorite moments in the movie, and this happens in Burning Down the House, is where the percussionist sort of pulls a face mm-hmm. to the camera, you know, mm-hmm. kind of acknowledges yeah. it and sticks his tongue out, and then we kind of move on. And it's a wonderful thing that it isn't so storyboarded, as you said, that you can't include this element in it. It feels just right, you know, plainly it's conceived and everyone is well prepared and there's a good plan in place, but it's not so rigid. I mean, you know, I think if you're, again, I don't want to bash Scorsese, he's my favorite filmmaker ever, basically, but that Rolling Stones documentary he did was
Shine a Light
was an example of a movie that's over storyboarded. I mean, he was a band that at that point had been, you know, they're running on inertia basically from arena to arena, and everything is planned, and there's no spontaneity to that film at all. Just a lot of style, good style, mm-hmm. but it's nothing. It doesn't feel as organic, I guess, as this does, despite it being very conceptual.
Well, I mean, that being said, do you have a favorite number in this? Your favorite section of the film? Favorite song?
I don't know that it's my favorite song, but in the context of the film, I really like Slippery People because mm-hmm. it's kind of the first time you get the full picture, you know, like everyone's on stage, the singers are doing their thing and Byrne is dancing. And it's just like, I feel like it's the first big peak mm-hmm. of the movie. It's like going down the roller coaster hill, kind of, you know, the adrenaline goes up a lot.
Yeah, I mean, things do sort of pick up, but the mine is a little bit earlier, but I have to confess, you know, I saw this film, I've been really trying not to think too hard about Jonathan Demme having passed, yeah. Because he was such an important filmmaker to me, and it's such a necessary voice now, right?
Yeah,
he's the anti-Trump, you know, he's the most humane, you know, globally minded,
sincere,
earnest, you know, true American, mm-hmm. Melting pot kind of a guy. And
definitely a believer in democracy as well, you know.
Totally. Yeah. And just in exploring new sounds. And, you know, so I was like fighting back tears through much of this film. Mm-hmm. And Burning Down the House was when I really got choked up seeing that. Because that was, I mean, you talked about Slippery People, you know, which is certainly when everybody's out there and mm-hmm. the whole machine is working. But Burning Down the House is an up-tempo number. It's their biggest hit, isn't it? Do they have a bigger hit than Burning Down the House?
I don't think so, no.
So it's a terrific song, and you know, everybody's on the stage. It's there's so much joy. I mean, that's the one where the percussionist pulls the face, which is one of my favorite shots in the movie. And, you know, so at least in this viewing, that was the song that really got to me.
I think maybe this time through, this must be the place. Cause I love that mm-hmm. song. I love the staging of that. You know, and we should pause to give some credit here to Adele Lutz, who was Burns' girlfriend at the time, later wife and designer, and did a lot of the stage design. And I believe she designed the big suit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the suit is so great.
But it's also a song that I haven't heard quite as often as the others, because I played this soundtrack to death. You know, this is one of the first tapes I bought. I listened to it a lot before I ever saw the movie. And in the 1980s, you couldn't fit all the songs on a cassette tape. So, and This Must Be the Place, remarkably, is not on the original soundtrack. It's on the expanded soundtrack version of this. So that one still sounds a little fresher to me. Actually, the first time I saw this movie was... Rock and roll was not really encouraged in my house.
He grew up in the town in Footloose.
Well, I grew up with parents who recall calling their friends when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan to express their shock and dismay that this horrid noise was let out on television. So this was actually I watched this movie for the first time on video cassette. One odd weekend, I'm not even sure where they went. My parents went out of town and left me as a 16-year-old, I think. I was responsible enough to be on my own. So I rode my bike down to the video store and rented, watched for the first time. This film and A Hard Day's Night, back to back. So wow. it was my rock and roll weekend. And
that sounds like a great weekend. That is a good, like, Keith Phipps origin story.
And I like how you're on your own at 16 and you bike, and you get a couple of music films rather than going straight to the unrated films and like the nude aerobics films or whatever.
Sure.
So I appreciate your dedication to the cinema, even at that age. But I agree,
movies and music, man. Movies and music.
I mean, this soundtrack was my first exposure to the Talking Heads. I mean, the track list is absurd. I mean, Psycho Killer, Heaven, Burning Down the House, Life During Wartime, This Must Be the Place, Once in a Lifetime, Girlfriend is Better, and, you know, Take Me to the River. These are huge songs, and I'm trying to think, like, were they all hits, or are they just hits because they're in Stop Making Sense and I've heard them my whole life and they're just classic songs?
Yeah, I think retroactively they're hits for those of us who are of the sort of indie alternative this is the Beatles of a certain type of music. I mean, I remember in the early 2000s, everyone wanted to be the Talking Heads that kind of faded. But I think their influence is still huge.
Yeah, for sure.
It's worth noting also, this is kind of the end for the Talking Heads as a live act. They had a few more shows after this. There's a show in Milwaukee, I think a couple shows in New Zealand, and then they stopped performing as a live act, which is, you know, it's hard not to watch this and just think about all the shows they could have done. But I mean, if I remember correctly, the tension was kind of between Byrne and the rest of the band. The rest mm-hmm. of the band wanted to be a touring rock band, and I think Byrne wanted to do, like, you know, theatrical numbers in between twin songs after a certain
Dance
point.
With Lamps.
Yeah, this seems to me that it's a nice mix of his artistic ambitions and stagecraft and actual the amount you can stretch what it is to be a rock and roll band and still be a rock and roll band.
I'll admit, like, I'm not a huge Talking Heads fan outside of this film, sure, which I love and is probably my biggest exposure to them. So I did not have that context that it was, like, kind of the end of them touring. And if there was any animosity, it does not come through in the performance or the film at all. Like, this seems like a group that really enjoys playing together.
Yeah, I'm not sure where everyone was. Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert on the biography of the band, but I mean, I think certainly tensions started to creep in increasingly after this as Burns' ambitions to be a filmmaker and all these other things started to distract from the band.
And I think maybe you can read a little bit of spatial disconnect between Byrne and the rest of the band in the sense that, you know, I mean, he starts by himself on stage. The other band members are going to have to wait to come on one at a time. And then there's a break where he goes off and for a costume change and the Tom Tom Club plays their one song, you know, and it's not really...
But I mean, really, that's a win for the Tom Tom Club, not Byrne.
It is that. Whenever I hear that Tom Tom Club song, what I actually hear is, "Let's all go to the lobby."
I'm with you, and I do love that song. I don't love this performance of that song. I mean, the recorded version of that is, you know, as evidence of being sampled on a billion different hip hop songs, is amazing. But live, it, you know. It's, you know, for all the wonderful musicianship on display, that live musician doesn't really work for me. Although Tina Weymouth's bass playing in that is pretty amazing.
But maybe that was kind of a somewhat difficult situation to have it grafted onto what was really the Talking Head show.
Sure, he needed time to put on the suit though. I'm sure Byrne appreciated the break to get into costume.
I wanted to say another thing about Stop Making Sense, which is I think I consider the film, especially after seeing it this time, to be an assertion of Demme's basic values as a filmmaker. You know, Melvin and Howard, I think, which he made in 1980, was one of the most important films about America, I think, made in that decade. But he's always been a director who's thought globally, you know, and he always appreciated this country the most when, you know, different voices were singing in harmony. And I mean, you look at a film like, you know, Married to the Mob, or, you know, Something Wild, or they'll have like, you know, a Haitian actor or some very quirky piece of world music that's unexpected. And he and David Byrne, who are very like-minded in the sense that, you know, they're both attuned to a lot of different sounds and the melding of different sounds, and it has a joyous sort of melting pot quality that would come through in his fiction films as well and give them that distinct something. I mean, I've talked about it before as being the Demme touch, like the Ernst Lubitsch touch, and that it's hard to identify and articulate exactly what it is, but you kind of know you're watching a Jonathan Demme film. And I think it's just because there's just all of this life that is kind of put into it in a lot of subtle ways. And one of those ways has to do with the incorporation of a diverse cast and diverse sounds and just this wonderful melting pot quality.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about like what the visual signatures that you can find in all of Demme's films, and nothing really comes to mind. They're all great looking movies.
Maybe in his concert films, you can, well, we'll get more into that in the second half, but I think you can definitely see some signature shots.
Sure. Yeah, sure. But it is really more, you know, like you said, it's a touch, it's an attitude, mm-hmm. it's sort of a spirit of it. All these sort of like intangibles that I'm sure are frustrating for a lot of people when we talk about them, but nonetheless, there they are.
Well, if you've watched the film recently, as you should, you'll know what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, where do you see, I mean, we talked a little bit about The Last Waltz, and, you know, my keynote talked about Let's Spend the Night Together, but where do you see this fitting into the history of concert films, and do you see its influence on subsequent concert films?
Totally. I mean, I think this changed the game. There's just certain values at play, specifically, well, a few things. I mean, one, planning, two, understanding how much of the audience to bring in, which is not much, but a little bit, mm-hmm. an important little bit.
When
you,
it
you
matters.
You can't do a concert film where you don't know they're there at all. But Demme's thing is to stay on the stage.
Go ahead. Sorry, I was just thinking of the Robin Hitchcock.
Storefront Hitchcock.
Yeah, Hitchcock. Like that one was just a really, did some interesting things with the audience where, because I mean, it was literally like people like passing by, you know? So that was like isolated him from the audience in a very like distinctive, purposeful way.
But yeah, and that was just one, too, I think, where, and we'll talk about this when we get into the Timberlake film, but I think he thinks hard about venue and how best to feature a musician, and if that means putting him in an arena, and it's an arena show, you do it one way. With somebody, if you got Robin Hitchcock with an acoustic guitar, you do it a different way. And here, I think the way the audience is incorporated is important and influential. Staying on the stage is the level of planning that it went into it. You know, the conceptual arc of the show. I mean, I think you can see that in a lot of concert films. I think it improved this. It just raised the bar for concert films. I don't think we really saw anything other than The Last Waltz and a couple of other films that were on this level.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of something like Rattle and Hum, which came a few years later, kind of takes the wrong lessons away from it, where I think it ups the visual sort of grandeur. It kind of takes what's here and runs with it, but it also forgets to keep the band human. It's just so much about the iconography of the band. It's like, I feel like some films took away the wrong lesson from this.
Well, I think for Rattle and Hum borrowed inadvertently from Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
I mean, they both have a scene in Graceland, for God's sakes,
where they're all
sort of acting as pretentious as possible.
Yeah.
But, you know, and again, with that movie, it's like, you've got U2. U2 is, you know, one of the most acclaimed live acts there is, you know, just stay with them on the stage and let it ride. So that one is an example. But of course, Demi himself would go on to do. I mean, his Neil Young films, particularly Neil Young Heart of Gold, is I think beautifully handled.
That's the only one I've seen. How are the other two?
Journeys and I haven't seen
Trunk Show.
I haven't seen Trunk Show. Mm-hmm. Journeys is good.
He did this film called Into Abitabile. I think I'm mispronouncing that. Music Life, which is about an Italian musician, which I wasn't that into because I wasn't really connecting with the music very much. But it is certainly another example of him kind of wandering the world and filming what interests him musically. I like Sir Alfred Hitchcock a lot, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, as far as other concert films go, I mean, a movie like Year of the Horse by Jim Jarmusch. I mean, that does have a lot of backstage nonsense, but the performances are shot in, you know, in 16mm and are very cinematic and feel like they share a lot of the values in common with Stop Making Sense. So I think it's quite influential. You know, and maybe some of these, you know, I don't know all of these live supplements that I was sort of talking about earlier, but, you know, again, I think it's a standard that filmmakers would work toward more often than not, you know, after this movie came out.
Culture films aspire to the condition of Stop Making Sense.
Yeah.
Anything else here that really kind of connects this to the rest of Demi's career that you see?
One thing, and this like kind of piggybacks on what Scott was talking about, just like kind of the appreciation for a larger world and a larger view, I guess, but just kind of the spirit of camaraderie that you sense on stage. Like, one of the things I love watching Stop Making Sense is watching them watch each other, which is something that bands have to do when they're performing live. But like, there's this great shot during Heaven where Byrne is in the foreground and Weymouth is in the background kind of watching him sing, and you know, she's watching him, like I said, because that's what bands do. And I could be wrong about this, but they don't have in-ear monitors. I don't know, were in-ear monitors even a thing at this point?
Oh gosh, I don't know.
So I think they're mostly depending on just their on-stage monitors for sound, which would make it even more necessary that they kind of watch each other for cues and watch Byrne specifically for cues. But you know, you see it with Byrne and the singers and kind of all of them, but just the sense that they are playing in part for each other, not just for the audience. They're not playing out at the audience, they're playing in. I think that's kind of like a heady, pretentious way to put it, but you know, there's a very kind of internal communal sense to the performance that I think is really of a, like, part of the Demi spirit. You know, I keep thinking in my head of the scene in Rachel Getting Married, the big like kind of musical communal scene there. And it kind of has that same energy of like, we're having fun creating something and putting on a performance. And oh, that I think that's kind of beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good, that the wedding in that movie is so great. I mean, I would love to have been at that wedding. Moments of awkwardness aside. The other thing to appreciate too, this is a tribute to the band, is how much they thought through every song and how they choreographed their little dances, you know, I mean, whether they're all doing this sort of aerobics on stage or they're kind of shimmying back and forth in time with each other. And certainly David Byrne has thought through, here's how I'm going to dance here and here, and then I'm going to put on the box suit and that's going to be a thing. And with every number, there's kind of a new surprise and a new dynamic beyond the music that has to do with just pure stagecraft. You know, and then of course there's there are slides and silhouettes, you know, and then of course just right from the beginning, just him, the striking visual of a bare stage and his little tape player and him, you know, it's just, and he's playing to the camera in an interesting way. There's just all these always constant surprise and constant movement going on a performance level that keeps the film interesting and keeps it from getting stale.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely what happens when a band that formed in art school makes a movie and puts on a show.
It's like Rhode Island, right?
Yeah, Rhode Island School of Design. But it's also, there's all these things pulling against that. I mean, the music itself is just so infectious and funky, and there's so much spontaneity in the moment. They've played these songs a million times, but does it seem like they've played these songs a million times? Never to me, at least.
No, I mean, maybe that's the magic of finding some extraordinary middle ground between, you know, the conceptual and the planned and the, you know, orchestrated and the spontaneous and dynamic and new. You know, just, it's a very hard thing to strike. Usually you're either in one camp or the other camp. Mm-hmm. But this film, both on a directorial level and a performance level, you know, sort of meets in the middle.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
All right. Well, with that, we'll wrap up our discussion for now of Stop Making Sense. We'll be right back with some listener feedback on our last episode. We went upriver twice with our last episode, a look at Burden of Dreams and A Lost City of Z. For one listener, this brought to mind another river trip. And this is the only real piece of feedback we got for this episode. And it's long and a little strange, but we like it. Scott, care to share this one?
Yeah, though I gotta say, I feel like one of those judges who's like, okay, I'm gonna allow this. I'm gonna allow this very strange thing. I don't want to see where you're going with this, but I'll try. Okay, this is Robbie in Chicago. He writes, "When I saw Burden of Dreams for the first time about a month ago, I was struck by another connection, something that could have been its own The Next Picture Show pairing. Well, maybe not. After watching Burden of Dreams, I watched the music video for the Culture Club song Karma Chameleon. There's a different kind of riverboat involved, but the aesthetic seemed similar to Fitzcarraldo and, by extension, Burden of Dreams. The more I thought about it, the more the two seemed linked." Was he on something here? We will see. Both works deal with the impossibility of trying to bring ideas into reality and the pain caused by the disparity. Karma Chameleon contains the line, "Lovin' would be easy if your color..." Oh, for God's sake.
Robbie is trolling Scott right now, and I love it. Keep going, Scott.
Karma Chameleon contains the line, "Lovin' would be easy if your colors were like my dreams," which I imagine would resonate with Herzog, at least the version of him in the film, who expresses how difficult it can be to know so clearly what you want and to see reality fall further and further away from that ideal. Both works depict men who pursue their dreams to their own detriment, even while realizing the damage they're causing themselves. "My love is an addiction." It's a line from Karma Chameleon. "Made worse by an inability to explain their desires to others, like the actors leaving the production of Fitzcarraldo and the fights with Klaus Kinski." There's a line, again, in Karma Chameleon. "I'm the man who doesn't know how to sell a contradiction. You come and go." The pain
you
of the creators...
"You come and go."
"You come and go."
We're butchering poor Robbie's letter here, but with a certain amount of affection and love here. The pain of the creators leads to Pyrrhic victories for both works. Fitzcarraldo was a lasting and revered work of cinema. Karma Chameleon became an enormous hit, but the pain that it took to produce these works, provided Karma Chameleon is autobiographical, is so clearly expressed, I can't help but wonder if that success outweighs the pain for the creators. And both are understood by modern audiences not just by the texts themselves, but by their broader cultural context, in many cases with the cultural context eclipsing the work's original meaning and reducing it to a joke. For some, Karma Chameleon is just a silly pop song with a chorus that sounds like, "comma, comma, 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 chameleon." And Burden of Dreams is just a source for Herzog impression material. P.S.
It keeps going.
Stuck in that mindset, I watched the Roberto Rossellini film Stromboli the following night, which bears a striking narrative/emotional resemblance to the Cyndi Lauper hit Girls Just Want to Have Fun, but that's another story for another time. That's a pretty great letter. I don't know. I'm going to leave it to you to unpack it. I think we should probably post this on the Facebook page as well so people can analyze it for just how serious a piece of work it is. But
I mean, if he's pulling our leg, he put in the work.
Yeah.
And to that, I say kudos, Robbie. And like, I buy it. You know,
For what it's worth, the Karma Chameleon video was directed and written by Peter Sinclair, This is, as a director, this is his biggest claim to fame. But as a cinematographer, he has had a long and still in progress career. Worked on a lot of music stuff. Was cinematographer for things like Sign of the Times and a couple of Madonna videos. He started out in British soft porn as the DP of a film called Adventures of a Taxi Driver, which is came out the same year as Taxi Driver. But I my understanding is they're very different films.
Do not use the term DP when discussing soft porn.
It's softcore. Come on. Soft porn. I was like, oh boy.
It's a no-P situation. But yes, so there's your background information. I don't know if that supports or undermines the theory at work here.
This is Boy George's vision, I think he's talking about more than Peter Sinclair's, I would say. But something to think about. And it's also, I think, one of those things where you watch a couple of things in a row or near each other and certain connections emerge. I mean, that's always one of my favorite parts of going to a film festival is just like a bunch of random films that made the slate. And then suddenly, you know, you've got three or four films with one really weird specific thing they all have in common. So maybe this is the same dynamic at work. But thank you for that, Robbie.
Yeah. This is a podcast about finding connections, and that includes cross-medium connections. So, well done.
So, as always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. And that wraps up this episode of The Next Picture Show. In part two, we'll bring in Demi's final film, Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids, to see how he approached a different sort of musical event. Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we may be saying to ourselves, this is not our beautiful podcast.
This is not our beautiful podcast.
This is not our beautiful house. You may tell